Congratulations, first of all.
Oh, thank you.
So, wow, big decision. So, yeah. What went into your decision to retire?
First of all, I'm a long-term planner, and we have done an awful lot here at Leaders about building up a very comprehensive strategic plan and adding on top of that, or maybe I should say building under that, some pretty ambitious key deliverables about growth and change and closing the meal gap for the first time in our history and so on. And I think that itself caused me to think more long-term. And I also originally came to Gleaners with a 3-year commitment, so it'll end up being 6. So my math skills are off, right? But I also think organizations need the right leader at the right time. And I'm certainly more a transformational growth or change leader than a maintain on the plateau type leader. And I think the Gleaners for the next few years will have some more growth and change, but then we'll need a stabilization period of locking in some of those change and growth. I feel like we've been locking in and stabilizing things as we go, but every organization needs a time to catch its breath.
Right.
Too. So a chance to find another leader that sort of can do that as well makes some sense.
So obviously one of the most transformative periods for Gleaners was during the pandemic. Can you tell me a little bit about how you navigated that and what changes resulted from going through that period?
Well, if you're okay, I might back up a little bit before the pandemic in order to answer that question, because the strategic plan I referenced that we started in February of 2019 began a lot of change and growth planning and set that goal of closing the meal gap and keeping it closed, which meant after 2019, we would need to do 2.5 times that year's food distribution and sustain it and do it in the right way. It did not mean we could expect 2.5 times the donations that people had historically given us. So we did dozens of things to improve our efficiency. And we went from 41 cents a meal when I got here to 12 cents a meal last year. Not with one magic thing, but dozens of things across the entire organization. We redefined every job, every role in the organization. And some of the more impactful ones when the pandemic came along were setting up program staff primarily as local service managers who had assigned geographies where they were meant to be out in the field, interacting, working with our partners, understanding the neighborhoods, understanding the counties, and knowing exactly what they needed from us to succeed. Not confined by historically what we had done for them or with them, but what do they actually need to do their part of closing the meal gap in their area and providing wraparound interconnected solutions, not just hunger and isolation. And they had that knowledge. They've been doing that from the February of 19 period. Well, we actually formally launched that in October of 19, just before the pandemic, but we were ramping up. So by the time the pandemic hit then in early 20, we already were equipped with that information.
That's great.
I would also back up and say, if we had not moved to this current location with this facility in 2010, we absolutely could not have handled the pandemic response. We might very well have done what happened at some food banks and many food pantries around the country, which was temporary shutdowns, and, you know, limiting our response and running out of food at distributions. But that didn't happen. We were able to handle it, because we were already on a growth and change trajectory. So, you know, in 2016, the meal distribution was about 20 million meals. The first year of the pandemic, we did 103 million. You cannot quintuple your distribution while simultaneously have dramatically improved the nutritional quality and unprecedented variety of foods that we've never had before. Highest ever percents of perishable food, you know, more dairy, more eggs, more milk, more produce, more meat than we've ever had. And we have absolutely left behind the old food banking model of passively waiting to see what loose cans and boxes people choose to donate, and then that's what we distribute. We've proactively, even maybe aggressively, gone after financial resources to go out and shop for food at the lowest cost and best nutritional variety we can. And try to create for the families we're privileged to serve as close to any other person's food shopping experience as possible. And that means things, though, like setting an 80% foods to encourage, a nutritional score for the food we distribute. Not 100%, but certainly not the 40% that it was a few years ago. The national goal for Feeding America is 70%, but the leaders chose 80%. But we didn't choose 100% nutritious and healthy foods. We want people to have the dignity of choice and options. And if they, like when I do the shopping, when my wife lets me go to the store, you might see Doritos or Haagen-Dazs or something appear in the basket. Well, why shouldn't the families we serve have some the full mix of options? So in that 20% that's not labeled nutritious are other choices. It is about respect and dignity and not being judgmental about the situation they're in, but simply helping in the way we would want to be helped.
So, John, so it sounded like a pretty lofty goal to make those changes preceding the pandemic. How did you go about getting that launched? What did that look like?
The strategy is absolutely our roadmap. After really about 9 months of the pandemic, we did an update to that strategic plan. We found ourselves in a sort of an intriguing way. We were checking off 2023 strategic plan goals early. But it also is not about having a document. You know, we had a great partner, by the way, in Chorus Incorporated, you know, the firm that helped us with that strategy and then went on to help us with a very detailed neighborhood-by-neighborhood plan for Marion County. We also mixed in their investment in our people. In many ways, we started with that. From an organization that was financially at risk in 2016 to one that is very stable and solid now, it was a financial journey. That financial journey began with my doubling the fundraising team when I got here. And much like corporations will use dramatic increase in sales to turn the company around, we used a dramatic increase in fundraising success to give us the resources to do all of the other things. The seed money to help us, to give us the few months of funding to do that, came from our friends at Lilly Endowment, much like many other organizations in town. But from there, we had to earn our own way. And so starting with the fundraising team, but then progressing to every single employee in the organization, jobs changed. We moved people around to jobs they fit better. I set a policy that we would only hire employees who would be qualified 3 to 5 years in the future, not just qualified for the job, the person who just left. And then we've, again, with strident purpose, I guess I would say, we have invested in every single employee in a personal growth plan every single year. And then what happens when you do that and you focus on the people and take the warehouse manager, when suddenly that warehouse is handling far more than ever perishable, nutritious food in the freezer and coolers that we, of course, we exploded beyond the space capacity of both. That was additional problems. But when they're doing many more multiples, faster inventory turns, the need for efficiency comes along with it. But what if they could only handle the job their predecessor had? Well, instead, along came the pandemic, and they're expected to do multiples of the same work with many more problems, challenges, and barriers in the way of that work. And we had hired a person who was capable. So no issues.
That's awesome.
And if you take that to every job across the organization, we were ready. But we weren't ready for the pandemic. We were ready to fulfill all the goals in the strategic plan that said we'll triple who we are.
So take me to the early stages of the pandemic. We're having people who never had to go to a food bank. And you mentioned that significant increase in meals passed out. What did that look like for your team?
Well, I'll focus again on the people side first. You know, obviously that meant a lot more work, a lot more stress and anxiety, solving more challenges and dealing with more barriers to getting the work done than really any time in our history. So it wasn't just more work, it was harder work, more complex work for every single Gleaners employee. It meant shortly into the pandemic, cutting off the volunteer program that had historically provided 40% of our work effort. When the work had tripled and got more complicated. The solution to that on the workload side was to integrate temporary workers that came with a budget-busting cost. And thankfully, our governor was one of the first in the country to mobilize the National Guard for food insecurity programs. So we had, it fluctuated, but 70 or so National Guard soldiers, and the combination of National Guard soldiers, employees working harder to the point of exhaustion in some cases, and the temporary worker soldiers and employees working harder, that's how we solved the workforce side. But we also changed a bit of how we were working. You know, as you can tell from other answers, I am a long-term planner. But our COO ran a daily huddle early every morning, and it was literally, what do we have to solve to get through today? Tomorrow we'll have another huddle. So it was a literally one day at a time, solve things on, you know, and that built on what was already a lot of success of cross-functional collaboration, department to department. And, you know, we were one team going into those huddles, and we became even more so as we just literally rolled up our sleeves and solved things on an immediate basis. Food supply became really, in many ways, the most complex challenge. Year after year after year, about two-thirds of cleaners' food was donated by retailers as surplus. Within the first 2 weeks of the pandemic, that went to zero. So just as we need three times as much food, or 2.5 times as much food, we lost two-thirds of it. We were thankfully the beneficiaries of many extra donations to cleaners. You know, now our team worked hard. We were creative. We tried everything we could think of to go out and fundraise more money, and it worked. So we had money to shop with, which is good because we were spending 9 to 10 times as much as the previous year on food. We historically would buy less than 10% of our total food. Suddenly we're buying over 50%, well over 50, and paying full market price, maybe even a premium, versus what historically for years and years was discounts of half of wholesale price from generous companies like General Mills and Kraft and Nabisco, who couldn't give us that discount anymore. And with apologies, sincere apologies, they were putting us in line behind all of the retail customers because they had to refill the Kroger stores and the Aldi stores and the Walmart stores. Those same stores who had just cut off surplus donations to us became our biggest competitors in resupplying our warehouse because they were resupplying theirs. And you've seen enough in the news about the disruptions of the supply chain and food orders that we could get a one-week turnaround on were taking 90 days and longer. Food orders that were on their way to our building in truck with pallet tags that said cleaners were diverted to the customers with no warning. Trucks disappeared for weeks. We didn't know where they were. They just weren't showing up. You know, so it also disrupted our space control because we were already bursting at the seams in our cooler and our freezer. Well, then when you're expecting, you know, a Monday truck and a Tuesday truck and a Wednesday truck, and all of a sudden none of them come till Friday, you have all those trucks at once filling up space that we didn't have. So we quickly began renting reefer trailers, temp control trailers. We had so many going at one point, over 30 at one point. And for a long period, it was 20-some trailers. We didn't have room on our grounds. We were borrowing parking spaces around the industrial park and sending a cleaner's truck around refueling the units on these trailers that were parked, holding refrigerated frozen food. And then it would draw down to almost nothing, and then it would spike up again. We could not keep the inventory level and predictable. So food was quite the issue. The government food fluctuated, too, because not only did we have the pandemic, but in the start of this year, when we had the change in presidential administrations, some of the USDA supplemental food programs that had been providing far more than usual food through USDA channels into the food bank system stopped. They expired. And so, I don't say this is a political comment or one about the administration. It's just that, you know, when the Trump administration, for example, put on some tariff mitigation steps to help farmers and growers who were affected by the tariffs on China and other countries, the food that USDA bought to help the farmers was given to the Feeding America network to distribute. That stopped. There were also some emergency or supplemental food coming through on top of, are you familiar with the Emergency Food Assistance Program or TFAP food that comes through? Mm-hmm. There was regular TFAP, supplemental TFAP, and tariff mitigation TFAP. That abruptly stopped in December to February with the change of administrations. And that was I've seen numbers ranging from 50 to 80 billion pounds drop nationally. So that was unfortunate timing. So even though as a system, we had typically, or take leaders, we had seen 8 to 9% of our total food come in through USDA programs. When we lost the retail access and the pandemic was was going up, we had all this extra government food for the first part of the pandemic, and that helped, but that wore off. So the percentage of purchased food has actually gone up, and it's still an unstable supply chain. Mm. Particularly, and now as the supply chain is slowly improving, the price inflation has hit us even harder. We're paying 20 to 40% more for meat.
Right.
We're paying high double digits increase in dairy. The produce items that we would go out and source, now we're having to shift down away from some of that wonderful nutritional variety that we built up. Now we're not buying berries from California. We can't afford it with the price increases. We're doing more potatoes and more onions and more cabbage. Nothing wrong with those, but the people we serve want variety just like you and I.
Sure.
So we've had to back away from some progress we had made with price inflation and certainly reduced quantities. Now, during the pandemic, we were able to successfully raise funds and add 40,000 square feet of cooler space that was constructed during the pandemic. That was phase one of expanding temperature control space. Phase two was to put in a USDA clean room that we can go out and get bulk meat or protein and dairy that is going to landfill as surplus or waste currently, primarily in bulk quantities, a frozen 500-pound block of extra chicken legs at a meat packing place that when they've done all the Kroger family packs of chicken legs and there's some left over, they freeze it and save it, many times don't use it, and it gets thrown away. Now that can come to us in this USDA clean room, which is named because there's a USDA inspector on site as we do this work. We partially thaw, we pack it, we label it under the oversight of not just the USDA inspector, but our food safety manager. And that can now go out and piggyback on the distribution that we've built around produce. And we're doing more and more of the dairy as well.
So, John, what do you see in terms of the future? So things are calming down somewhat. What are you envisioning for the future in terms of, it seems like the visibility of gleaners has increased significantly. Apparently, you've built more partnerships, is that correct?
Yes.
What do you see moving forward, like maybe for the next 2 to 3 or 5 years?
Well, we have a strong focus on building the capacity to close that building and keep it closed. And we have driven some paradigm shifts in thinking in recent years, in addition to no longer accepting that it's okay to have a meal gap of hundreds of millions of meals missed by Hoosiers every year, and saying it, from now on it needs to be zero. We also admit that our downstream partners do a wonderful job distributing food neighborhood by neighborhood, whether that's a pantry or a soup kitchen or a community center or what. But if they were going to be able to find the resources to install a cooler or a freezer or to get their pantries expanded and set up to handle the full menu or variety of foods that gleaners had to offer, they would have done it by now. So we have actually taken financial reserves from gleaners and money from several other donors. We're fundraising still for more to go out and, with a very careful, disciplined, prioritized process, do capacity building grants to our partners. Now, admittedly, it's unusual or any nonprofit to go out and raise funds and spend some of their savings, so to speak, for other nonprofits. Normally they do their own fundraising, find their own resources, but it's so critical. It's a bottleneck. It's like gleaners is finding more and more food or pouring more and more into the top of a funnel, but the narrow end of the funnel stays the same. And we hate throwing away milk, eggs, healthy, nutritious produce because we don't have enough places to send it enough quantity. The other thing that really bothers me, and hopefully you're picking up, I'm a very people-centric person. I think about the outcomes for people. Just because of the coincidence of geography, people in one neighborhood have access only to cans and boxes, where a pantry one neighborhood over may have the whole rich nutritional variety available to them because the pantry in their neighborhood has a cooler and a freezer and wire shelves for produce and a big enough doorway to send pallets through. And that other pantry, they have to make do with far less just because of where they live. Not fair. So we're trying to equalize the opportunity across our entire 21-county service area by investing in capacity building for these downstream partners. So that will continue as a top priority as we continue to invest in the gleaners facility and fleet and equipment and process flow improvements. In fact, we're working with a firm called Delve Design to help us really fine-tune that and build out what we need in the future, fully prepared for a closed meal gap. What, not what our current state needs, but what our future state needs. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that planning and capacity building will continue. We're stabilizing the financial resources of the organization for the long term. We're really investing a lot in people and their growth. We've had some really rewarding proof that promoting within and sometimes pulling somebody from one functional area to a different area to round out their skills, it's working. We've been moving fundraisers into buying food. We've been moving food sourcers into production in the warehouse. We've been programs people are coming and going in and out of programs. And what seems to be a trend-defying move, too, is our millennials are staying. And they're getting promoted, and they're getting more rewarding opportunities, and they're having more and more decision-making authority, and they're teaming up and collaborating together. And so the people dynamics are particularly rewarding, both inside the organization and for those that we're serving.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So any last comments about advice for other organizations going through transition? Any lessons learned that you might want to pass along to other nonprofits?
Well, as you can tell, I am more long-term oriented. I'm more future-oriented. I think nonprofits tend to underestimate their own capacity. They tend to focus too much on maybe even exaggerated concerns about today's challenges. And if they would build in a discipline of planning long-term, planning for the future, setting goals, and I would say in our case, neighbor-centric goals, and working back from where they need to be in the future, some of those current state things don't happen or just resolve themselves. So this, if you have a mindset as a nonprofit that, well, we're short-staffed, we don't have enough funding, or, you know, if you're in that excuse-making mindset, you can diminish what you get done versus a more optimistic grow to where you need to be mindset. And what you project is what your stakeholders see and hear and respond to. So as we have, you know, when we talk about a Gleaners that needs to run at 2.5 or 3 times the meal distribution that we had in 2019, and when you go to a partner organization or you go to a donor, or you go to an elected official or whoever that audience is, and say, we can do this. We can do this in 2023 and 24 and 25. If they have skepticism, you say, oh, by the way, we already have done that for 2 years of pandemic under pressure. So we know we can do it in normal times.
That's awesome. Well, again, congratulations.
Well, thank you. I'm
very happy
news,
for
you. Tell between now and September, right?
So. Yes. Yeah, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you the best.
Well, thank you. Very nice of you to do this.
Enjoy your day.